Hi everybody, today is Friday, April 18th, 2025, and our friend Larry Johnson is back with us. Welcome back, Larry.
I am happy to be here. Thanks.
Larry, yesterday, last night, we've learned that the United States has attacked Ras Isa port in Hodeidah in Yemen. And so far, from what we've learned from the Ministry of Health in Sana'a, they're talking about 74 people have been killed and 171 injured. And right before coming out, the breaking news right now is that Yemen has attacked Ben Gurion and has targeted Ben Gurion Airport in Israel with a ballistic missile called Zulfiqar. And they have targeted two aircraft carriers, two aircraft carriers of the United States in the Red Sea, if I'm not mistaken.
I think there's only, isn't there only just one carrier strike group in the Red Sea? They're saying that there are two?
No, it's one of them is USS Harry Truman, and the other one, USS Carl Vinson.
Yeah, I thought the Vinson was down in the, was in the Arabian Sea. Indian Ocean.
I don't know. They said that they have attacked both of them.
Okay, so well, yeah, they could have, right, you know, they could have launched one at the Vinson. That's always, you know, going after the ships is always much tougher than going after the airport. I was doing a show yesterday with Garland Nixon, and someone who represented themselves as a Navy vet was saying, oh, those Houthis, you know, they're crap because they can't do any, you know, they claim that they can hit Ben Gurion Airport, but they can't hit a U.S. carrier. Well, I said, well, for starters, Ben Gurion's airport doesn't float and it doesn't sail around in a body of water. It's a fixed location. So, you know, you sort of know where it is. The problem with ships is that the Houthis don't have an intelligence surveillance reconnaissance capability. Basically, they've got to rely upon some dude in the boat that's out there and say, oh, hey, I see where this U.S. ship's located, and they can send the coordinates that way. But, you know, the ship's moving. And so it's not like there's a magnet on the ship that draws the missile to it. So just from that standpoint, it's a very challenging, I guess, task to try to attack the carrier with one of the ballistic missiles. Now, they can do it with a drone, assuming that it's being piloted and they've got video capabilities on the drone, so they can see where they're going. If that's another tactic they could employ, they could bring the drone in, locate the ship, and then try to fire the missile. But hitting the ship and finding the ship is difficult. I was involved with both scripting and executing counterterrorism exercises for 23 years. And several times we would do the exercise and that would involve pirates have taken over a ship or terrorists have taken over a ship and the U.S. has to respond to go save it. And even the United States, with all of its great technology, would have trouble finding it. So, but it's noteworthy that here are the Houthis. Man, can't stop them. They're like the Energizer Bunny. They keep going and going and going, despite, you know, Trump's claims, oh, we're going to unleash holy hell. Yeah, we're killing civilians, and that's hell. But the U.S., despite, you know, the number I heard last week was over 500 sorties, 500 different flights, attacks, bombing runs, haven't been able to stop the Houthis at all. And in fact, I don't know if you saw the news. I just saw the news this morning. The Houthis claimed that they shot down their 20th Predator drone. So they're now, if you figure that those drones cost $40 million, They've shot down $800 million worth of drones. But more importantly, they've shot prior to this you know, March 15th. The Houthis are shooting down on average about one drone a month. Now they've shot down five in a month. So that's, you know, they're getting better, not worse.
It's all about experience that they're having.
Yes.
How about the experience on the part of the United States?
Well, you know, we're finding out that we're not as strong as we like to think we are. And that we've got some limitations of, you know, we've talked about this before. They're trying to destroy these missiles, the ballistic missiles that the Houthis are firing. Well, they're not at a fixed, again, they're not at Ben Gurion Airport, or they're not at Cape Canaveral. They don't have a fixed base where those missiles are pointed up in the sky ready to be launched. If that was the case, yes, the United States would have destroyed that already. No, but they're out there moving them around. They're on trucks, and they got mobile launchers, so they can drive out to a location, set up. You know, it may take 10, 15, 30 minutes to set up even, but they can fire and then move off. Well, the United States, apart from the drone, the Predator drone, doesn't have the ability to immediately identify. It's not like we've got a big map that lights up and says, hey, there's a missile being launched in sector, you know, ABZ. And then we can target it immediately. No, it's just, you know, people may see that crap on Hollywood, but that's not real life. So with a Predator drone, yes, the Predator can spot it in real time. So they've got, you know, the operators controlling it. You've got the visuals below, and the Predators can carry a whole variety of pretty potent weapons. So it could be used to destroy one of those mobile missile launchers. But the Houthis figured that out. And so if it's a real mobile missile launcher, it's being accompanied with some air defense capability, and they're shooting the Predators down. I don't know if it doesn't appear the U.S. has learned anything from this yet. Recognize that they keep shooting it down. It's not like we've got an unlimited supply of these, you know. Then they're damn expensive, and they take a while to build. So this is the lesson I hope Donald Trump and Pete Hegseth and others are learning in the current Trump administration, is that there are actual limits to U.S. military power. Just because, you know, we can stand in front of the muscle and mirror and flex our muscles and say, oh man, I'm a stud, doesn't mean that you're actually competent to go out and fight. And I think the limitations of U.S. military power are being exposed.
Larry, in terms of the article published in the New York Times, they're talking about there is some sort of division within the Trump administration in terms of attacking Iran. Do you find it realistic, or they're just making new rhetoric? And here is, before responding to that, here is what Donald Trump said about that sort of idea, that article.
Did the attack as well?
That you waved off an Israeli plan to attack Iranian nuclear facilities.
I wouldn't say waved off. I'm not in a rush to do it, because I think that Iran has a chance to have a great country and to live happily without death. And I'd like to see that. That's my first option. If there's a second option, I think it would be very bad for Iran. And I think Iran is wanting to talk. I hope they're wanting to talk. It's going to be very good for them if they do. And I'd like to see Iran thrive in the future, do fantastically well.
Yeah,
it sounds like, based on that article, that J.D. Vance, Susie Weiss, the chief of staff, The surprising name on the list was Pete Hegseth, and then Tulsi Gabbard all argued against it. Now, I think the basis for the argument is that the U.S. intelligence community, if they're doing their job properly, will have said, look, the last time Israel tried in October 27th, when Israel tried to attack Iran, their planes, Israeli planes, could not get closer than 70 nautical miles from Iran's border because they were then being lit up already with electronic signatures coming out of Iran. In other words, Iran has an over-the-horizon radar system. They can detect what's going on out, you know, some distance outside. And it also that despite, you know, U.S. claims and Israeli claims, that, oh, man, we kicked their ass. Boy, we wiped them out. They don't have any air defense left. The reality is otherwise, that Iran fended off the Israeli missiles. They did very, very little damage. The word going out is Iran, since that attack on October 27th, has boosted its defense systems. It has entered into a cooperative security agreement with Russia. And as part of that agreement, Russia is providing extensive military support to Iran, but Iran in its own right has its own technologies that it's developed and its own, you know, air defense system capabilities. So I think that they gave Trump an honest assessment saying this, you know, if we do this or let the Israelis try to do it, it'll be a disaster. You know, we'll lose. This is, you know, this is worrisome. The good news, and I wrote about this, is that not everybody surrounding Trump are crazed and loony. They're not insane. They were able to sit back and properly assess it. But this raises the question now with respect to what happens tomorrow, Saturday, in Oman, because the United States and Iran are supposed to sit back down and talk again. Which is good, except Witkoff in public has been reversing himself. He's done, you know, a complete about face. And, you know, the Iranians are like saying, what's going on? Why, you know, this is not how negotiations are supposed to take place. You know, don't come in and give us assurances and then withdraw those assurances and take the exact opposite position. And part of the problem is Witkoff doesn't understand, he's not an expert, and I don't profess to be either, but at least I know this much from reading from people who are experts, that Iran's enrichment program is, Witkoff says it doesn't need to be more than 3.8%. Well, excuse me. There's part of the program that needs to be 20% because that's used for medical isotopes. And it's used as part of medical treatments for cancer and other things. So clearly Iran's not going to stop doing that because it is peaceful. The only thing you have to worry about is if you're enriching uranium to the point of getting it 90%. You know, you look it up, the natural uranium that people, you know, that's picked up out of the ground, that's mined, is uranium-238. And so when they talk about enriching it, they're talking about creating uranium-235. That's when we hear this concept about enrichment. That's what's going on. So Iran, I think, is quite willing and ready to make a deal to cap its enrichment and to allow outside inspection to verify that they don't have a bomb. I think they're absolutely telling the truth. They don't have a bomb. What's fascinating is how Iran's in a different position today, both diplomatically, militarily, and even economically than it was 10 years ago. You know, 10 years ago when they signed on to the JCPOA, China and Russia were imposing sanctions on Iran. Iran was completely isolated diplomatically. The United States had started a proxy war with Saudi Arabia against the Houthis, who the Iranians were backing and supporting. The Iranian economy was a disaster then. It's still somewhat of a disaster now, but it's, you know, it's limping along. But it was then also in sort of life and death struggle in Syria, trying to support Bashar al-Assad, who was under attack by Western-backed Islamic terrorists, by ISIS, al-Nusra, and later Hayat Tahrir al-Sham. So, yeah, it was under some pressure to agree to that back then. Now, different world. It has a strategic military relationship with Russia. It is engaged with strategic military exercises with China. It has deep diplomatic and economic ties with both Russia and China. And we saw yesterday that the foreign minister Araghchi.
Araghchi
was he was up in Moscow talking to Putin about, okay, we got this meeting with these crazy Americans on Saturday, and this is our position. You know, we've coordinated it with you before, because I'm sure Russia's been giving them. Russia's not going to tell them, hey, you do this or else. But Russia said, look, you know, let's prove to them that you don't have a nuke. We'll help prove that to them. And if that's their only issue. Now, I maintained, while Trump keeps saying, no, they can't have a bomb. That's bullshit. That's not the real reason. They want to find a reason to destroy Iran, because Iran is a stepping stone for attacking Russia. This is all about attacking Russia. And the United States, no matter what they say, oh yeah, we're seeking peace with Russia. Nonsense. I don't believe it for a moment. We're one of the most cynical, devious countries in the world. And I'm sorry to say that.
And actually, we've seen something rare, something not so much common in terms of the relationship between Russia and Iran recently. In terms of negotiations, Larry, we had the foreign minister of Iran delivering a letter from the supreme leader of Iran to Russia, which shows, as the foreign minister says, which shows how Tehran views Moscow as a strategic ally.
Yes, yes.
And the nature is.
Go ahead. Sorry, I apologize to interrupt.
I was wondering if the United States appreciate or understand what's going on between Iran and Russia in terms of any decision on their part.
You are really hilarious, man. You are an optimist. This is your youthful optimism. You think that there's some smart people in the United States thinking about this stuff? Ain't happening. Yeah. I wish how you viewed the world, because you're talking from a sensible, intelligent standpoint. Man, that's not how Washington works, at least in my experience. You don't put people that have deep knowledge and understanding about, let's say, Iran, in positions of leadership. Someone was writing that what happens is these people become Iranian experts, you know, put the quotation marks around it, because they've read the books that are all written from a Western perspective about Iran. They've never been to Iran. They don't speak Persian. And they keep they keep repeating sort of this construct of what Iran is. Oh, number one sponsor of terrorism. Oh, it's this religious authoritarian state that there's, you know, no freedom whatsoever, you know, without actually being able to understand and look at it from Iran's perspective. And also from Russia's perspective. And they're not looking at this, you know, when I think Russia is really sort of the driving force in this now. They've fully come to understand what a threat the United States and Europe poses. And I think they've realized that there's nothing that they can say or do that's going to satisfy the West. That'll be enough. We will continue our efforts to subvert and destroy. So as they look at their strategic picture, the last thing they want to have are hostile forces on its southern border and on its northern border. Now, the Baltic states, it's like getting bit by a flea, okay? It itches, it can be irritant, but it's, you know, not life-threatening. They're not carrying the Hanta virus. And, you know, you can live with that annoyance. But for years, formerly under the Soviet Union, they faced what they thought was a threat from China. They cultivated close relationships with India to keep that shored up. And the relations with Iran were shaky. So now what Russia's doing is solidifying those relations. So that now has sort of a solid wall of support to itself. And Iran plays a particularly important role, as we've talked about before, with that north-south transportation corridor, which allows goods to be moved in and out of Russia through Iran. And it's going to be an economic boon for Iran as well, provide jobs and help turn the economy around. United States, all we're looking at is how do we get rid of the long-term view is really it's China. But a stepping stone for dealing with China is to peel off Russia so that Russia becomes a new enemy of China. And this was first written about in a RAND report back in 2019. It was followed up in December of 2020 by this article by A. Wes Mitchell that we talked about, I think, on Monday, that was in the National Interest. And basically, you know, coming up saying, how do we achieve this split to keep this peel off Russia from China? And the plan was, let's basically attack Russia, defeat it militarily, and force it to come to recognize that it's weak and has to align itself with the West. I mean, it's talk about perverted, crazy, devilish, but that's what happened. And, you know, you start looking back now with the benefit of hindsight, the United States started building up its transport base in Poland in November of 2021. Now, this is 3 months before Russia started the special military operation, but the United States knew that, and Russia had actually a peace agreement on the table that, while Biden initially said he'd accept it, Blinken, you know, told Lavrov to screw off and then go shove it up your ass. So the United States was preparing for that. We were provoking Russia into the war for this long-term, you know, so there is that type of strategy at work, unfortunately, but none from a peaceful standpoint.
Larry, the United States is sending a lot of bombs to Israel. And do you believe that they want to use them in Gaza, because Gaza is just totally destroyed, or they just providing Israelis with bombs in order to use them against Iran?
Well, both. I mean, they're going to, the United States wants to ensure that Israel's in a position to continue killing civilians. And that disgrace of Ambassador Michael Huckabee is now on scene. Good God. You know, all he is doing is encouraging the religious extremists. There's Alistair Crook writes a Substack, Strategic Culture. And I really encourage people to read that. Because one of the things he publishes every at least once a week, and sometimes more frequently, his wife, Aslin, is a scholar in her own right. She speaks multiple languages, has lived, attended Hebrew in university in Jerusalem. So what she does is she goes through and translates the Hebrew press. Now, the Israelis, they have English language news services, you know, Haaretz, Ynet, Times of Israel, Jerusalem Post. But when you read what's actually written in Hebrew, they're telling a different story. There are things that they do not cover or present in the English press. It's in the Hebrew side. And what they've revealed in this is Israel's internal divisions are heating up to the point of civil war. That you've got a growing number of military personnel, both retired and active duty, that are calling for an end to the war in Gaza, a negotiated settlement, and certainly not attacking Iran. So it's a quite different picture than what you get if you just watch the English news, which, all the Israelis dancing around in a ring, dancing the hora, and, you know, everybody's happy. No, they've got some real serious internal problems. That's one of these wild cards that could change the whole picture. If Bibi Netanyahu dies within the next 2 or 3 months, because he does have prostate cancer and he's had a heart issue. He's not a healthy guy. And, if he doesn't wake up some morning, then Israel's got, they're in a real dilemma or predicament, because clearly nobody, there's not a leading candidate to take the reins. And there's a split. Alistair talked about this extensively. I did an interview with him yesterday. I maybe posted today, that you have these European Jews, you know, called the Ashkenazi. They tended to be more secular, more, if you will, European. And then you've got this religious Jews, the Sephardic Jews, and they're religious extremists. They believe that this land is ours. God gave this land to us, and anybody else that's on it is an evil person that we have to destroy. So you got those two groups. I mean, there's no compromise between that. These are, there's some things where you can find a compromise. There's no compromise here. One side's going to have to prevail over the other. And Netanyahu has aligned himself with the religious crazies. And if they come to power, then they're going to make decisions that will lead to the destruction of Israel, in my view.
Hamas announced that they're ready for a permanent ceasefire. They're ready to exchange hostages, prisoners. I don't know if that would be interesting on the part of the United States to put pressure on Netanyahu, if that would make some sort of, I don't know, provocation in the mind of the Trump administration to find another solution. Because Hamas is ready to talk. Hamas is ready to exchange the hostages. How about Netanyahu? How long does he want to continue the conflict? Is the United States willing to continue to the end?
As long as it takes. Takes for what? To purge the land of Palestinians, to clean them out, to exterminate them. This you know, Israel is never going to agree. The current crowd under Netanyahu would never agree to a Palestinian state. That's why when Hamas was created, you know, organized and formed in 1987, I believe, you know, I've had some people that write to me and say, oh, it's a Mossad front. And no, it's not a Mossad front. However, Mossad did funnel money to it through Qatar and other cutouts. Not that, you know, I don't think Hamas necessarily knew that they were getting money from the Israeli intelligence service. Then Israel was doing it for one purpose, that Hamas would oppose the Palestinian authority of Yasser Arafat and others back then. So they would never have a peace agreement. They were actually almost inciting and encouraging Hamas to carry out attacks. So Israel would have an excuse saying, see, we can't agree to peace because you damn Palestinians, you don't want it. And it was a very cynical play. So Hamas, I believe, has, you know, it has risen in stature, not diminished in stature as a result of this war. And but Netanyahu is not going to negotiate with him. Now, there are in this dissident, these Israelis that are, you know, opposing the war, including military officers. Many of them are calling for, we got to have a Palestinian state. Let's stop this war. Let the Palestinians have a legitimate state and we'll stay the hell out of their way. And, you know, we'll leave each other alone. That's what they want to do. But it's these people that are bound by and are the hostage to this religious vision from the Torah and the Old Testament that claims, oh, God gave this land to us. We're special people. We're better than everybody else. And this is ours forever. So get out of our way. As long as they believe that, then they're going to continue to act on it, and you're going to continue to have the bloodshed.
We had something new in terms of the relationship between Iran and Saudi Arabia. The defense minister of Saudi Arabia went to Iran.
You read my piece?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Good man. Sodar21.com. We'll put it in the advertising. Exactly.
Right here, below your peg. Yeah. And Larry, it seems that if you remember when this rapprochement has happened between Iran and Saudi Arabia, many people were skeptical about what would happen after that. What can this sort of new attitude bring to the relationship between the two parties? What we've learned so far, how does it work in terms of the relationship between the United States, between Saudi Arabia and Iran?
Well, you know, as I mentioned earlier, 10 years ago this time, the Saudis and Iranians were basically at war, a proxy war in Yemen. And, you know, the Yemenis proved to be a pretty tough customer because they could continue to hit oil fields in Saudi Arabia and creating problems. So, you know, now it's 2 years ago that through the intervention of Russia and China, they brought about this reconciliation between Iran and Saudi Arabia. So they started, they met, you had Mohammed bin Salman, you know, MBS meeting with the Ayatollah Khamenei. And, you know, it appeared that the nature of the relationship was warming up. Still, the Saudis are still playing a bit of a double, you know, they still had a foot in the Western camp and a foot in the Eastern camp. And, you know, they're sort of going, but you couldn't say that they were a reliable partner. This meeting that took place yesterday and the exchanges, public exchanges of what each side said, signaled to me a deepening of that relationship, that the Ayatollah pledging that the Saudis are their brothers in Islam, and the Saudis vowing to stand with Iran. I think this is driven by a number of factors. First, I think the Saudis are really leery of Donald Trump and his administration, particularly the killing that they're allowing to go on with of the Palestinians. I think they recognize that the United States is serious, at least seriously entertaining the notion of attacking Iran. And the Saudis, I think, worry that if that happens, their own oil fields could become a target as part of a Iranian retaliation. So they want to wall that possibility off. They want to let Iran know, hey, we stand with you, not with them. An interesting indicator that the United States may be preparing to attack is the reports are out there now closing down three military bases in Syria, withdrawing the troops. So, Trump has always wanted to do that, but I don't think this is designed to ease tensions in the region. It's to reduce targets that the Iranians can hit in retaliation. I think, unfortunately, that we'll find out tomorrow. I mean, today's Friday. When we get to the talks in Oman, if Steve Witkoff continues to insist that Iran has to walk away from its its enrichment program and get rid of its missiles and end all relations with the Houthis, Hamas, Hezbollah, Iran's going to say, we have nothing more to talk about. When you're ready to come and seriously negotiate, give us a call. Otherwise, goodbye. That means we'll be headed to war. And so from that standpoint, I think the Saudis were anticipating that possibility. And this was, if you will, a preemptive action on their part. It certainly sends, I think, a strong message to Washington that the Saudis are no longer, they're not playing, the Abraham Accord is dead. Until the plight of the Palestinian people is settled, the Abraham Accord is dead. The Saudis are no longer going to be used, manipulated, because that's really what has happened in the past. The Saudis were always seen by the United States as somebody we could use to attack and weaken Iran. They've been just a tool. There's no real relationship, friendly relationship between the countries. The Saudi Arabias were just like a piece of toilet paper and we'd wipe our ass with it. Sorry for the crude analogy, metaphor, but that's exactly how they've been treated.
Larry, you've mentioned the way that Witkoff is just talking with Iranian, and right after the talks he put out in his interview with Fox News, he was talking about 3.67% of enrichment. And here is what he put on the social media on X. He said, Iran must stop and eliminate its nuclear enrichment and weaponization program. What's your understanding? What's your interpretation of the, he wants Iran to stop enrichment and eliminate weaponization program? What does it mean for you?
Well, number one, they're not weaponizing, they're not weaponizing uranium. They're not trying to enrich it at 90%. So it's like me telling you, Nima, I want you to stop driving that Lamborghini. And you go, I don't have a Lamborghini. How can I stop driving a Lamborghini? I don't have one. Hey, stop weaponizing that uranium. And they're going, well, we're not weaponizing it. Okay? So that's a straw man argument that Trump's putting up. Maybe he can declare, see, by God, we got them to stop weaponizing. Yay, we give us credit. The concerning part was the preceding clause, where it cease enriching uranium. Now, Iran is going to insist, correctly so, that we have every right to engage in a peaceful nuclear enrichment program. For our the energy purposes, yeah, 3.67 is fine. We can live with that, but we will be enriching at 20% because that's for medical purposes. Hey, we'll let you come in and inspect.
We'll and NPT you... allows that, Larry.
Yeah, yeah.
NPT allows that.
Yeah. So, you know, it's up to Witkoff, because I think one of the first questions the Iranians will have tomorrow is saying, you know, Mr. Witkoff talked about last week, we're willing to provide full guarantees that we're not enriching uranium to weaponize it at all. That's not a problem. You know, we agree with you on that. But it appears now you've shifted your position and saying that we can't enrich at all. Is that really your position? And if Witkoff goes, oh, yeah, it is, then, you know, I don't know. I don't know what the Persian word for fuck off is, but, you know, that's essentially what the Iranians will politely say and exit the meeting.
You don't believe how rich the Persian language is for that. So.
Ah, there we go. So the big
you
reveal.
You have multiple choices in that.
Yeah. So this is, you know, this Iran's got to accept the Trump deal or nothing at all. What? Sorry. That's not how negotiations work. And Iran is not over a barrel like it was in 2015. That's what people need to understand. It's a different world today. So, and this gets back to, you know, the frustration with Donald Trump that, you know, people welcome the fact that he came in and got the border closed and deporting all these illegal immigrants that were allowed to flood the country. But then his bull in the China shop approach, whether we're talking about how he's trying to deal with Russia or how he's dealing with the Houthis and now Iran and China and the tariffs, it's really counterproductive. There are ways that he can approach the issue. You know, and I would have sat down, like you said, we're going to impose tariffs. So what's your ultimate goal? What outcome are you looking for? If you're looking for some sort of deal with China where China is going to, you know, be amenable to making some changes in its trade policy and doing things that we want them to do, then insulting them is not the way to get that to happen. You know, it's like there's a girl you want to date, and you don't start off by calling her fat and ugly. You know, she's not going to want to go out with you. And the same thing, you know, a girl looking at a guy is going to say, hey, you're stupid, you're ugly, you smell. No, there's the foundation for a great relationship. So this is, you know, across the board, the bullying is, I think, becoming a thing of real concern. You know, what's interesting, this it takes us off on a little bit of a detour, but a lot of these China experts in the United States are seized on a comment yesterday that essentially that some Chinese official reportedly said, well, if the United States stops talking mean to us, we'll negotiate. And the people on this side were going, yeah, man, see, our tough stance is forcing those Chinese to come around. And I sent a note to Pepe last night saying, is this going on? And he had a colorful Brazilian expression that dealt with male bovine excrement coming back. And he said, no, are you kidding? The people, the Chinese are very united on this. It's so puzzling how my countrymen, many of my countrymen, are incapable of actually listening and trying to understand how our actions are making these other countries feel, and how they'll react. It's unbelievable. And we've gotten away with being the hegemon for so long. I guess we think we can continue to, you know, bully, push people around without any consequence.
Larry, we had the meeting between Donald Trump and Meloni, in which he talked about the situation with Russia. Here is what Donald Trump said.
We'll see what that will be. We're going to be hearing from them this week, very shortly, actually, and we'll see. But we want it to stop. We want the death and the killing to stop.
And here is what Marco Rubio
determined very quickly now, and I'm talking about a matter of days, whether or not this is doable in the over the next, you know, few weeks. If it is, we're in. If it's not, then we have other priorities to focus on as well. Not working yet on that level of specificity. I think that's something we can fix and solve in a way that's acceptable to everyone. I think we have bigger challenges that we need to figure out whether it's even possible within the short term. I can tell you this. This war has no military solution to it. It really doesn't. It's not going to be decided with... Neither side has some strategic capability to end this war quickly. There are probably elements of this as well. I always remind everybody that part of the sanctions against Russia, many of them, are European sanctions that we can't lift if that's ever to be part of a deal. So they're going to have to be involved no matter what. It's their continent. This is happening on the continent of Europe. And so obviously European powers will care deeply about what happens. So they have a stake in this, and we recognize it. And they, but in the end, I think we all want the same thing. I think from the U.S. perspective, we've spent 3 years, billions of dollars supporting the Ukrainian side. But now we've reached a point where we have other things we have to focus on. We're prepared to be engaged in this.
Yeah, we have other things to focus on. Larry, both Donald Trump and Marco Rubio, they're talking about they're waiting for some sort of response from Russia. What I'm afraid that they're not going to get the sort of response they're waiting for.
If they want to end the war, it's real simple. Cut off the intelligence the U.S. is providing. Cut off the flow of money and weapons. Withdraw U.S. intelligence and military personnel from Ukraine. If Trump wants to stop it, he can stop it because we're facilitating it right now. He's pretending like he's got nothing to do with this. It's crazy. He's like, oh, this is Joe Biden's war. No, buddy, it's yours. And you're going to wear it. And if you want to stop it, you can stop it today. Rubio is absolutely wrong. Oh, there's no military solution. He's a moron on this. He doesn't know what he's talking about. There's an absolute military solution, and that's what Russia is going to deliver. And it's in the process of delivering. You know, I think on Monday I mentioned to you, again, use one of the artificial intelligence search engines. And ask the question, how many towns, villages, cities, hamlets has Russia captured and held since January 2024? Get a long list. That's the same thing with respect to Ukraine capturing and holding territory from the Russians. Zero. Okay? So that's not a stalemate. That's the exact opposite of a stalemate. And Russia right now is launching offensive operations on a larger scale than it ever has in the preceding 3 years. And it's all along the front. It's in Sumy. It's in the Kharkiv region. It's down in Donetsk, in the western portion of Donetsk. And it's down in Zaporizhia and Kherson, all along the front. And candidly, Ukraine doesn't have an answer for it. And this offensive is just going to continue to accelerate because Ukraine does not have the force. There will be a military solution. And this notion that Russia is going to agree to a ceasefire, no. Now, if the United States walks away, like Rubio's suggesting, yeah, that'll bring an end to the war faster. Because without U.S. intelligence support, the Europeans, look, the Europeans don't have any kind of military power at all relative to what Russia has. They're kidding themselves. And without the United States in there taking the lead, you know, it's like they're like five guys who are, you know, sort of working stiffs. They don't have a lot of money, and their best friend is Elon Musk. And so they let's go out to dinner. And so they're, yeah, let's go eat at this restaurant. Let's go to this bar. Man, they're spending money right and left because they know that Elon's going to pick up the tab. And finally, when the day comes and Elon says, hey, guys, have fun. I can't come out with you tonight. Oh, what do you mean? We got to pay? Oh, we got a problem. That's exactly what Europe's going to run into. They don't have the money, and they don't have the manpower. They don't have the industrial base. They don't have the military technology. They don't have the intelligence collection systems. But other than that, they're looking really good.
Larry, in terms of what it seems that the United States is offering Russia to ease sanctions, just lifting some sanctions on Russia in order to convince them that they can reach some sort of ceasefire. But in terms of easing sanctions, do you think that this sort of policy would work? When it comes to Iran, it seems that the upper hand on the part of the United States would be the sanctions, that Iran is asking for them to lift the sanctions. But how about Russia? How does Russia really want? Is that necessary, as the case of Ukraine is for them?
No. I mean, Vladimir Putin gave a speech now 2 weeks ago to the industrialists in Russia. And he basically said, hey, if any of you are trying to make your plans about your future business on the notion that we're going to get the sanctions lifted and everything with the United States and the West is going to be A-OK and we'll be, you know, singing We Are the World, he basically said, forget about it. That's not going to happen. He said, the West is always going to find an excuse to impose sanctions on us. So what we've decided to do is to go our own way. And that means we're going to be working with BRICS. We're going to be setting up this alternative system. We'll try to have good relationships with the West. We don't want to be at war. We don't want to be antagonistic. But we're not going to be held hostage by these bastards. And he's very clear about that. So, you know, the West can indulge all of its fantasies. Oh, yeah, we'll keep... They want to get out from under our sanctions. Russia does not care. They did at one point. They no longer do. They have recognized that they must chart their own independent course. And, you know, the West deludes itself into believing that we still got some leverage over them. You know, Trump doesn't have a single card to play against Russia. Because the Russians know they're not going to agree to a ceasefire. Because they've seen every single one's been betrayed in the past. It will be a military solution by them, or it'll be a diplomatic solution according to the terms that Vladimir Putin laid out on June 24th. 2024, that were reiterated this week by Sergei Lavrov. He said it again about a month ago when I was with him, along with Judge Napolitano and Mario Nafal, and Naryshkin, the head of Russian intelligence service, said it again the other day. I mean, you know, the Russians keep saying it over and over. We're just got our fingers plugged into our ears and going, la, 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 we can't hear you. We don't want to hear what they're saying. listen to them, and then you understand if you want to end the war in Ukraine, Zelensky's got to go, the Nazis got to go, and the Ukrainian military is going to be whittled down to where it's a police, a National Guard police force. Russia is no longer going to allow the United States to build up a proxy army on its border that is then used to attack Russia.
Do you think that Donald Trump and Meloni talked about the situation in Ukraine? I would wonder if Meloni still represent the same attitude that she had in during the Biden administration. She was just totally in line with the rhetoric of Washington together with.
No, I don't think so. Did you see she gave a presentation the other day where, I mean, she was blasting Macron and the French for being a bunch of, you know, corrupt imperialists, basically, talking about how they issued a currency to Francophone, to the, you know, the some of the countries in Sahel, and that, you know, the young children were being forced to go into gold mines to mine gold, and that all the profit was going into the banks in France and not to the people in Africa. And she goes, this is why we've got an immigration problem, that we don't allow these people to have the money that they earn that should go to them. Instead, it's being robbed by these French. I mean, she was blistering. So, no, I don't. She ain't going along with Macron and Starmer crowd on, yeah, let's see if we can start World War III with Russia. No.
Larry, in case of China, we know that Russia and Iran are closer than ever. And for the case of China, do you think that if Donald Trump is in a position to decide about which way to go, confronting BRICS or cooperating with BRICS, which I was talking with Alex Craner today earlier, and Alex believes that the future lies in some sort of cooperation between mm-hmm. the East and the West. This is the only solution for that. Confrontation is just the destruction and yeah. nothing else coming out. But if we assume that Donald Trump, on the part of Iranians, let's assume, and on the part of Russians, if Donald Trump decides to lift primary sanctions, not secondary sanctions, primary, that which allow the American businesses go to Iran, to Russia, to cooperate with them, to produce their goods there and all of that, which would bring some sort of relationship between Russia, let's assume between Russia and the United States, which necessarily doesn't mean that you're separating Russia from China.
Oh, heavens no. No.
Yeah. I mean, it's some sort of relationship that can expand and can improve.
Look, the reality, what the United States is laboring under the assumption, the false assumption, that because we're the third largest country in terms of population in the world, and we are like, we consume 30% of all the goods that are produced in the world. We're like a ravenous locust. Russia and China have no alternative but to deal with us. Basically, as Trump said, they got to kiss our ass. Well, Russia and China aren't interested in kissing U.S. ass anymore. And China has been recognizing the growing belligerence on the part of the United States, the United States creating this construct that requires us to view China as a growing imperialist military power that we have to stop, that because they're a threat. If we don't stop them now, they're going to be a bigger threat in the future. So China began shifting operations away from being dependent upon the West. Notice that it has... what are the consequences of the current tariffs is to make it almost impossible for U.S. farmers who grow soybeans to sell those soybeans to China. It used to be like 57% of the U.S. Soybean exports went to China alone. Well, it turns out China started importing more soybeans from Brazil than the United States starting about 4 years ago. But it's accelerated. And now that China and Brazil have agreed to trade in their own currencies, that means they're no longer held bound by the dollar. And a lot of these commodity transactions that are taking place with under the BRICS umbrella are no longer featured the U.S. dollar. So the commodity indexes in the United States, they're sort of blind because these transactions are outside their ability to capture those. I think China is moving to basically create more export markets in countries around the world. Now, the United States reportedly is trying to threaten countries. You got to stop. Either you do what we want to do and we'll cut your tariffs, and that means you got to stop doing trade with China. Most, you know, again, the United States doesn't make things that are so essential that other countries, if they don't have them, they die. Whereas China does. So, you know, I think, and the bullying part of the U.S. approach is, I think, particularly off-putting. So we're going to see, you know, I think we'll see BRICS continue to grow in strength, and the United States, you know, it will suffer a major economic crisis, which will make it increasingly irrelevant.
Yeah, Bloomberg reported that China cuts U.S. oil purchases by 90%, Larry, 90%. And Financial Times reported that China stops buying the U.S. LNG. And these are huge changes. And on the other hand, we've learned that they're just replacing the United States with Canada. And Canada is just providing them with oil.
Yeah,
I would wonder what would be the strategy on the part of the Trump administration, because if they go that way, it's going to be so much difficult to get back. To get back to the, do they really believe that they're going to be able to just get back and bring everything to what it was before?
Yeah, no, this is. again, I try to bring it down to human levels that we understand that, you know, if you've got an abusive spouse that's just beaten to hell, you know, punched his or her partner and caused physical damage, and then later said, okay, I'm sorry, man, I'm having a bad day, I drank too much, let's get back together. You reach a point in that kind of relationship where you say, you know, you're not worth it. You're not worth the cost. And I think that's where China is right now. You know, when they canceled all the deliveries from Boeing, they're going to start buying commercial jets and jet engines and such from Russia. And Russia will work with China to help Chinese produce it. The Chinese has got the industrial capability to do that. And the workforce. So that, you know, the United States is no longer the linchpin holding the whole economic order together. We have become destitute by virtue of our spending on endless wars overseas. And we have alienated too many countries. The U.S. alliance with other countries right now to Trump is really, you know, he's been very damaging in that regard. You know, I think he's, it's just shocking. He can be this bad in terms of finding ways to alienate other countries that we ought to be partners with and that we would have some natural alliances with. You know, there are ways to try to, you know, China certainly has done some things from a trade standpoint that we don't like, but there are other ways to go about resolving those problems. pulling the gun out and shooting first is not the way.
It seems part of that plan to confront China is Europe and the tariffs on Europe. The main goal is to separate them from China. Right. I would wonder if Europe is in that position to suffer from a new war, economic war between the United States and China. That would, you know, what has happened to Europe. Germany just announced that we've learned that they're moving Mercedes Benz, they're moving their some part of their factories to Hungary because in Hungary they have cheap Russian gas that they can produce.
Yeah,
they cannot receive it directly from Russia because that's forbidden. I don't know who has forbidden.
Yeah. No, it's you know, Trump's policies vis-a-vis Europe, alienating most of Europe, especially Germany, France, England. No, this is, you know, Russia, I think, is just enjoying the chaos that they're seeing. Because there's nobody in Europe has got a great economy that's booming along. Russia's economy is growing at the rate of 4% last year and is anticipated to do the same this year. Despite Western claims, their economy's in the tank. Oh, you know, please. Keep lying to yourselves and, you know, you will continually be disappointed.
Larry, are you, just to wrap up this session, are you optimistic about tomorrow's meeting between Witkoff and Iranians?
No, I'm actually not. Boy, in Monday morning, you get to come on and say, "Hey, old man Johnson, you were wrong." And I'll say, "Thank God I was wrong." Because, look, I hope that sanity will prevail on the part of the United States. It's not Iran that's being a roadblock. It's not Iran that's being intransigent here. It's the United States. And there is a deal to be had. All the United States has to do is come in and say, okay, look, what we want, we got to have a complete, solid guarantee that you're not going to be building a nuke and you're committed to that. And Iran says, sure, we can do that. That's not a problem. I mean, it's really that simple. But I don't think the United States, frankly, because of the Zionist influence that surrounds Trump, is willing to take yes for an answer. And so I think it will, the talks will end and the fear of war will then grow. The reality, though, is the United States and Israel both have limited, you know, despite the tough talk, their ability to actually carry out any kind of effective attack. I mean, for God's sake, the United States has flown over 500 missions against the Houthis since March 15th, and we haven't stopped them. And we think Iran's an easier target? Please. You know, yeah, just say no to drugs, please. Just say no to drugs.
Thank you so much, Larry, for being with us today.
All right. Behave yourself. And to all who celebrate Easter, happy Easter.
Happy Easter. Take care, Larry.
All right, my friend. We'll see you Monday.
See you. Bye-bye.
Bye.